This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. We have something special today. Terry's interview with Questlove, Amir Thompson, that was recorded last Sunday on stage in front of an audience of about 800 people. Questlove is the drummer and co-founder of The Roots, which became one of the first working bands in hip-hop, at a time when the music typically was sampled or played by studio musicians. The Roots also are the house band for NBC's The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon. Questlove wrote the show's theme. He's produced recordings by D'Angelo and Jay-Z and the Hamilton Cast album. He's considered one of the great DJs, drawing on his passion for music of all sorts. He also wrote a terrific memoir called Mo Meta Blues and a book about the TV show Soul Train, one of his obsessions. He has a new book called Something to Food About. It's a collection of his interviews with celebrated chefs about how their creative process applies to the preparation and presentation of food. The interview was recorded at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology in West Philadelphia, just about 20 blocks away from where Questlove grew up.
I want to ask you about Prince. Mm-hmm. I know Prince meant a lot to you musically and as a person. Mm-hmm. You've told the story on our show and in your book and in other places about how when you were 12, you kept buying one of his albums. Your parents, who had become Christian, kept like throwing it out.
Throwing the records away, right.
So you had to keep rebuying it and hiding it, like, yeah. I don't know, 8 or 12 times over and over again. Mm-hmm. And you knew Prince. I don't know, how well did you know him as a person? And was it possible to know him as a person?
It was a complex relationship. In the beginning, it's fearful, like, because you're meeting your... I don't even think I said words the first time I met him. It was just... And plus, he acknowledged what I did. He was like, I really like that video. I was just talking backwards, like, how do you know I can't even say it now. Like, how does he know I'm alive? Like, how does he know I exist? The second time we spoke, I kind of asked him, I said, yo, I gotta let you know, like, I didn't think you'd be this normal and speak complete sentences. Like, I mean, you know, like the kung fu grasshopper voice that you expect Prince to have, like, well done, Cincy. You know, that sort of thing. And then one night, just out the blue, he ambushed us. I was working on Common's Electric Circus album, and the phone rang, and the receptionist said, you know, it's for you, and I picked up. And he says, hello, can I speak to Prince? I said, who? He's like, you know your name means Prince, right? I said, who's this? He said, Prince.
And Amir does mean Prince.
Yeah, it does.
I looked it up.
Yeah. And he's like, are you going to be there for a little bit? And I said, yeah, you know, we're mixing. And he came by at, it was already 3 a.m. Like, we played him some songs we were working on. And then he gave us, like, it was a 4-hour lecture on religion.
He was a Jehovah's Witness.
The thing about, like, when people find, like, newfound religion, it's like they're so on fire for it for, like, the first 7 years. So I think I caught, like, year 3, where he was just, like, at the pinnacle of it. And so it's me, Bilal, a singer we worked with in Common. And you remember the cover of The Who's The Kids Are All Right? Like, they're all asleep on each other's shoulders. Like, cut to 7 o'clock in the morning, and, like, this is, like, me, Bilal, Common, one other person. Like, we're just literally, like, yes, we get it. And, you know, Prince is like a coach. Like, furthermore, you had to da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I was just like, yo, like, it's so surreal. Like, the guy that got me on the most punishments and the guy that introduced, like, the concept of anything lewd or sexual is, like, now turning to my parents. Like, when did this happen?
But could you ask him anything like that? Like, why did you convert? Or when did you become this person?
Well, okay, so there was one time at the studio, he has a curse jar, a cuss jar.
You have to put money in it if you curse?
Okay, so we're at Paisley Park. And I don't know, maybe I'd let the S word slip. I don't know what your...
This will be broadcast.
Thank you. And he was like, yeah, that'll be a dollar. And he grabbed the, just like, the water bottles that you put in. He's like, that's a dollar. He said, actually, no, you're rich. That's $20. And I said, huh? He said, no cursing. I said, cursing? I said, wait, you're the one that taught me how to curse. But the thing was, is that when I said that, I saw the look on his face. And when I walked away that night, went back to the hotel, I was like, wow, I wonder if he really felt bad about that. Like, if he thinks in his head, like, man, I've ruined a generation. Like, no, but he really felt that. And I felt that with a lot of his secret philanthropy and a lot of the Robin Hood stuff that he was doing. And I mean, real deep political, like saving schools and people to this day not knowing where this $3 million check came from. Like, that was all him. I felt like maybe in the last 20 years of his life, he felt the need to overcompensate or pay for it, what he feels that maybe he damaged some of us who grew up listening to his music. This is weird, but I mean, more than that, I mean, he was also like a real funny person. One of my favorite moments ever was the night that Winnie Fallon, Jimmy's first daughter, was born. I got a call on the bat signal. When Prince calls you, it's kind of presidential, like an assistant calls, an assistant's like real meta, like, he will talk to you now. Whew. And that sort of thing. And so the assistant was like, where's Jimmy at? And I said, oh man, his daughter came today. So, you know, we had the night off. We're going to show a rerun tonight. And he says, well, relay this message. Prince will be at Susan Sarandon's Spin. Susan Sarandon owns a chain of ping pong clubs where you go in. It's like a bowling alley, but for ping pong. So Prince will be at Susan Sarandon's Spin till about 1 a.m. And he wants to challenge Jimmy to a game. And so I responded. I said, okay, well, all right. But, you know, he just had the baby, so I'll make sure he gets it. And then the response was, okay, just let him know around like midnight tonight, Prince will be there. I was like, no. No, no, I don't think you could. He had a baby. Like, okay, well, he'll be at Spin tonight. Like, wait, it's like, it was totally missing it. So I hang up the phone, I kind of doze off a little bit. And around 11:30, I was just like, wait, what part of baby did he not get? I said, wait a minute. So then I called Jimmy. I'm like, yo, man. I said, Prince just hit me up, said he gonna be at Susan Sarandon's Spin around like midnight or so, and wants to challenge you to a game of ping pong. And then Jimmy responded, wait, right now? I was like, dude, you just had a baby. You're not gonna do this right now, are you? Do you think I should? I was like, dude, you know you can't do it. He's like, yeah, but this is Prince we're talking about. This is once, like, who gets to play ping pong with Prince? I said, look, take it. And then I connected the two of them. So the next day, next day, a camera blocking rehearsal, Jimmy says, 10:30 tonight, it's going down. I said, what? He's like, I'm going to challenge him. So I said, am I allowed to watch this? Or, you know, Jimmy says, yeah, you can come through 10:30 tonight. So, of course, on a mirror time, 10:30 means like 10:50. So I get there almost like 10 minutes to 11, and this gust of wind passes me by my back, and I don't even notice it. I see one of our showrunners and producers outside smoking a cigarette. I said, so did I miss it? Did I miss it? She's like, wait, you just missed him. There he goes. I said, huh? And I turn around. SUV's about to pull off. I'm like, yo, wait. And I run to the corner. It's a red light. And just like the Grey Poupon commercial, like, the window comes down real slow. And it's Prince, right? with the paddle in his hand. And he's kind of doing tricks with it. He's like flipping in his hands. I said, wait, I missed it. What happened? And he says, green light. Ask your boy. And it goes up. But then I follow it. I said, whoa, wait. And then I say, you have a golden ping pong paddle? So Jimmy's story was that Prince was being nice to him for the first two rounds and then dusted him 19-2. But on the very last one, he did a slam. Like, if you remember how like Tom Hanks was in Forrest Gump's, with he's that level of competition. So Jimmy says the last round he was toying with him and he decided to just slam the ball. So Jimmy went over to get the ball like from under the table and then got up and said, hey, good, get, and Prince was gone.
So I want to ask you a little bit about your father, Lee Andrews Thompson, who died last month at the age of 79. Very sorry. He, of course, was the lead singer of the group Lee Andrews and the Hearts, a doo-wop group from the 50s.
Yeah.
Teardrops, Long Lonely Nights, Maybe You'll Be There. I'm going to play a little bit of one of his songs, of his big hit, Long Lonely Nights.
Okay.
Long, long and lonely night, I cry my eyes out over you, wondering if I did right and why you left me with a broken heart.
Do his records, and what did his records when you were growing up mean to you? You traveled with him on the road, I know. You were a real showbiz kid. Yeah. You did lighting for him.
Yeah.
You played drums with him when you were like 11 or something. But in terms of his records, what have they meant to you over the years?
The one question I'm always obsessed with parents today with their kids when I meet them, I often wonder, do they trick their kids into their taste? And, you know, sometimes, yeah, like a lot of times I'll meet kids that are 2 and 3 years old and they know every word to Don't Stop Till You Get Enough or Billie Jean. And my parents wisely tricked me into thinking that doo-wop music was current music. In first grade, I went to Philadelphia, the private school version of Creative and Performing Arts. First day of school, our assignment was to bring in your favorite 45. And so the next day, kids were bringing in Shadow Dancing by Andy Gibb or Yvonne Elliman or Disco Duck by Rick Dees. And I brought in Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, Why Do Fools Fall in Love? And my teacher started laughing like, you listen to this? And I was like, yeah. And she didn't believe me. And she was like, oh man, this is music when I was a kid. And then suddenly I realized, oh, my parents tricked me. Like, these are old records, you know.
So your grandfather, I think on your father's side, was a member of the Dixie Hummingbirds, the great gospel group.
Yeah.
And of course, doo-wop and gospel harmony is very connected.
All right.
And I know your father didn't really like hip-hop, at least not at first. He didn't like rap.
Yeah.
Did your grandfather not like your father's music?
I gotta really, really be honest with you. See, you're kind of disarming in your conversation, like, now I gotta be honest with you. For the longest, journalists would come and talk about William Beachy Thompson.
Your grandfather,
yeah. Of the Dixie Hummingbirds. And I would deny it. What? That's not my grandfather. No, you're wrong. And then I go to my Wikipedia page, and someone keeps putting it back.
You mean, is that true? It's really not your grandfather?
Hear me out.
Okay.
I mean, this is going on forever and forever and forever. Now, what I did know of my grandfather's relationship with his children, it was a short run, and there really wasn't that much love in the household. It was a very volatile situation. My father's rearing, his growing up in that household. So he really didn't have fond memories of my grandfather. Now, 4 months before he passed, the Roots got honored on Broad Street with one of those, the Walk of Fame things, and yet the umpteenth journalist was like, this is amazing, three generations of Thompsons on Broad Street. You, your grandfather. And I was like, don't say it. And you know, and finally, I went to my dad, and I was like, I said, Dad, I said, I gotta tell you something. For like the last 12 years, all these journalists and everybody have been coming up to me saying that William Beachy Thompson from the Dixie Hummingbirds is my grandfather. Is that true? And it was the most painful kind of ambiguous denial ever. Like, my dad sort of like matrixed his way like out of so, well, you know, I, you know, that's what they say. And I said, Dad, is my grandfather William Beachy Thompson of the Dixie Hummingbirds or not? And he finally said, yes, he is. Okay, there, he is. And that's kind of how I found out. Now, I feel horrible for all the countless family members down south that like, hey, cousin, we're William Beachy Thompson. That's not my grandfather. You know, that like, I've had millions of those moments. So right what? Now, I'm slowly doing research because I just got this confirmation 4 or 5 months ago.
Shortly before he died, shortly before your father died.
Yeah,
I'm glad you were able to ask him.
Yeah.
Why didn't he tell you with pride?
Because they did not have a good relationship. And I don't know, like, I kind of wanted to go there, but at the time my dad was in the hospital sick, so I didn't want
right.
to get into, Dad, I would have loved to know that, you know, that sort of thing.
So has finding out that your grandfather really was a member of the Dixie Hummingbirds gotten you in a more kind of gospel direction in terms of your listening?
No, I mean, I'm on a gospel kick before the ironic reasons. The last like 2 months, my broker has been like scouring like all these gospel records for me.
Cause you got somebody buying records for you.
That sounded real 1%, didn't it? I'm sorry.
It's okay, you're obsessed with me. It's a good obsession being obsessed with music.
No, it's just, but buying records is a time-consuming thing, and it's one thing if I'm
you'd be signing autographs the whole time you were in the store. But listen, here's a kind of paradoxical thing. So it turns out genealogically you're from this harmony family,
mm-hmm.
right? And you come of age musically as a performer in a kind of music where it's just not about vocal harmony. It's just not. It's rapping and with the Roots, mm-hmm. a band. So do you miss that kind of harmony? It must be so in your blood.
Part of me misses it. At my dad's service, he wanted members of certain doo-wop groups to come back and sing together one more time. So
wow.
I drummed and I sang. And when I was singing it, I was just thinking about being 12, 13 years old, singing all those parts. And yeah, I missed it because I haven't done it in such a long time. So part of me does miss the memories of those moments of playing doo-wop music. Like my father, I always tell this story and people think I'm kidding. My father did not know about the Roots until our second album.
Did you not tell him? Why didn't he know?
No, I didn't tell him about that.
Why didn't you tell him?
Because, I mean, our legendary bickering over the merits and the artistic value of hip-hop. You know, some people will go by the radio and hear, like, one line, like, oh, get that garbage off for it. You know, in his case, like, we just got cable, and so, you know, you might see one NWA video in passing and like, oh, you think that's art? Like, that's supposed to be better than Pet Sounds? And totally, like, dismiss a whole culture. But I kind of had to let him know because, like, we were in newspapers by that point. So it's like, yeah, I got a record deal, by the way. Sorry.
You know. So before he died, did he come around to accepting that your music was really valuable, that meant an enormous amount to so many people?
I'm going to tell you that I had the perfect TV movie ending conversation with my dad, in which we were able to, for like 3 hours, really have that talk where he said, you know, I know you thought I was hard on you, and I do apologize for the things that you didn't agree with and da-da-da-da-da, but I wouldn't let you know that I'm really proud of you. And like the thing that you would want, that validation that you've been dying for your parents to say to you on their like dying day, like I had that conversation and I knew that was my last conversation with them, and it was perfect. So I have no issues whatsoever with, you know, how it ended. It was a lot of turbulence, but it landed perfectly.
Glad you had that.
God, this is like therapy.
I just want to say, you are so wonderful, and I'm so thrilled that we had the chance to do this today. Thank you for
doing it. I enjoy this.
You're
one of my favorite. Give it up for Terry Gross, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you so much, and thank you for coming.
Amir Questlove Thompson is drummer and co-founder of the hip-hop band The Roots. He spoke with Terry last Sunday in front of a live audience. The most requested photo at the National Archives shows President Nixon shaking hands with Elvis Presley at the White House on December 21, 1970. A new film imagines what happened when the two met. Elvis and Nixon stars Michael Shannon as Elvis and Kevin Spacey as Richard Nixon. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Like many people, I can't get enough of Richard Nixon, and not just in relation to Watergate, which Bob Woodward called the gift that keeps on giving. In Harry Shearer's online series Nixon's the One, he showed you could make a great psycho comedy simply by performing the transcripts of Nixon's Oval Office conversations. And the charming new film Elvis and Nixon goes a step further. It dramatizes the meeting of two American icons and illuminates both men's strange minds. In December 1970, Presley actually delivered a letter to the White House asking to meet with Nixon and be appointed a federal agent at large in the war on drugs, though no such title existed. Yes, Presley had scandalized conservatives in the 50s, but the movie shows him to be a fundamentally well-mannered Southern boy who loved his guns and his country and only abused legal drugs. He's appalled by much of the counterculture. He fantasizes going undercover and bringing drug dealers to justice, and he gets his meeting. It's hard to imagine the weirdness, the sheer discontinuum of Nixon and Elvis together. Nixon's alienation from the pop culture of his day was total. He didn't know rock and roll, but he knew it was made by his enemies, long-haired kids who flouted authority. In the movie, Kevin Spacey's Nixon assumes Elvis is like all the others, maybe worse, as he rambles to his aide, Eagle Bud Crow, played by Colin Hanks.
You know, Crow, guys like that who are just born good-looking, well, you obviously know. They never had to work for it, if you know what I mean. Not me, no, I had to make something of myself to get a girl to notice me. It wasn't just handed to me by some sort of genetic lottery. I wasn't born looking like a Kennedy, you know. But that's why guys like me are survivors. But guys like this Elvis fellow know underneath all that they're weak. They wither at the first sign of trouble. They just crumble like a sand dune.
There's a subtext to that scene in Elvis and Nixon. Nixon never got over losing to the photogenic John F. Kennedy, and he's pickled in bitterness. Kevin Spacey captures, as no one I've seen, the stiffness born of terrible insecurity, that lack of elasticity that made Nixon so ill at ease and such a stickler for protocol. Michael Shannon plays Elvis before the weight gain, but after Presley's alienation from the world. Shannon doesn't do much of an Elvis impersonation, but I think he nails something in Presley, the casual, soft-spoken kingliness. This Presley believes that he can bend the world to his will, and it's a riot when he saunters into federal offices and causes people to freeze in disbelief. Everyone bows down to him, no matter how ridiculous his words, with the notable exception of the African-American characters, who plainly resent his appropriation of their music. Director Liza Johnson has the right sprightly touch. The film comes in at a trim 86 minutes, but not all of them work. Perhaps out of fear the audience won't relate to either Elvis or Nixon. The filmmakers often focus on an old chum of Presley's, Jerry Schilling, played by Alex Pettyfer, whom Presley drags to Washington and who's forced to choose between the king and his own fiancée back in Los Angeles. It's not a painful subplot, only formulaic and inessential. But the last act is everything it should be. A title crawl informs us no tape exists of the actual Elvis-Nixon meeting. But if it didn't happen the way it does here, it should have. Nixon is disarmed by Presley's denunciations of hippies and war protesters, which really was how subordinates won Nixon's confidence, attacking his enemies even before he could. You can't believe what you're seeing. In their insane way, these two lost souls connect. Elvis and Nixon is a doodle, but it's not as slight as some of its critics have complained. In addition to depicting its title characters in a new light, it shows the crazy-making insulation of celebrity. Elvis and Nixon, each in his own way, have so much power, but their windows on the world are now funhouse mirrors, reflecting back, even magnifying, their own nuttiness.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed the new film, Elvis and Nixon. Our next guest is one of the most popular actors of our time, Tom Hanks. Here's just an abbreviated list of his films. Splash, Big, Sleepless in Seattle, Philadelphia, Apollo 13, Toy Story, That Thing You Do, Saving Private Ryan, You've Got Mail, Charlie Wilson's War, Captain Phillips, and Bridge of Spies. He's won two Oscars. His production company, Playtone, also has a long list of credits, including the new film in which Hanks stars, A Hologram for the King. It's adapted from a novel by Dave Eggers. Hanks plays Alan Clay, a middle-aged American businessman who is sent to Saudi Arabia, where the king is planning to build a new city in the middle of the desert. Clay's job is to convince the Saudis to let the company he works for provide new state-of-the-art IT technology and support for this new city. Terry spoke with Tom Hanks last Tuesday and began with a scene from the film. His character, Clay, shows up at the desert location to find his IT team is being housed in a large tent with no food, spotty Wi-Fi, and no one to complain to.
King is not coming today, so you guys can just relax.
Shouldn't we call corporate and let him know the conditions here are untenable?
No, Brad, we should wait until I talk to Kareem Alamod at 3 o'clock.
Do you know why we're not in that building?
Well, maybe all the vendors are in here. And maybe we're just the first.
Kind of weird being Relling than being out here.
It's a brand new city. It's uncharted territory, and we are the trailblazers.
Where are we supposed to eat?
Guys, come on! We are in the kingdom of Saudi Arabia! With the deserts, and the camels, and the sheiks, and the tents!
Oh! Oh my God! Are you okay?
Yeah. Don't you know, they can only kill me with a golden bullet. Golden bullet, you know, you get it? It's Lawrence of Arabia.
Who?
Tom Hanks, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Wonderful to be here, Terry.
So what was it about the Dave Eggers novel that made you want to adapt it into a film?
Well, first, it's the dilemma that Alan Clay is in, which is the dilemma, I think, of our times. If you're going to sum it up in one word and one word only, you would say Alan Clay is dealing with China. the fact that China has taken away the companies that he's worked for, the living that he used to make, and it's representative then of all the other failings that he's experienced in his life. He's divorced, he's got a kid he can't afford college for, and he's now taken whatever skill set he had, which is really basically selling things, and he is going to have to go off to a place as alien on the planet Earth as I think Mars is in the solar system. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, accent on kingdom.
So what did you identify about this person who is emotionally and geographically alone and lost, who's lost his confidence? It's kind of the opposite of the position we think of you as being.
Well, you know, I have been alone in a lot of hotel rooms around the world for long periods of time in which I know I have to get up in the morning and create something that I may have an instinctive ability to do or may fail miserably at. I do recognize that sensibility of 3 o'clock in the morning in a foreign land in which you have to have a passport in your briefcase in order to allow yourself entrance and exit. That is one aspect of it, too. The other one is, I think, something that is real to all of us. The shark terror of a loss of confidence in ourselves. No matter who we are, no matter what we've done, there comes a point where you think, how did I get here, and am I going to be able to continue this? When are they going to discover that I am, in fact, a fraud and take everything away from me? It's a high wire act that we all walk, and I do this in the work that I do because there are days when I know that 3 o'clock in the tomorrow afternoon, I am going to have to deliver some degree of emotional goods. And if I can't do it, that means I'm going to have to fake it. And if I fake it, that means they may catch me at faking it. And if they catch me at faking it, well, then it's just doomsday.
So you shot in the desert of Morocco. What were some of the things that went wrong in the desert?
Well, you have your average sandstorm. That's a fascinating thing. That literally comes in like they know it on the weather. They say, tomorrow there will be a sandstorm, and it will last for 18 hours. And sure enough, in the morning, there is a thick orange cloud, and there is the finest particles of sand, more like chalk or flour that seeps in through every crack in the window underneath every door sill. I went back to my hotel room. We were shooting out in the middle of the desert near a place called Tantan, Morocco, but we were very much out in as the deserty as you could possibly ask for. Everything in my room was covered with a fine layer of golden/orange grit. So that wreaked havoc with some of the eyeballs of the crew and some of the sprockets of the machinery. There is that, which is, you know, it's kind of an adventure, actually, in order to be a part of.
The film is produced by your production company, Playtone. Why did you start your own production company?
I didn't want to be the actor who just sat at home and waited for the phone to ring. I was very lucky that Jonathan Demme directed Philadelphia, and through that I met the man who is now my producing partner, Gary Getzman, who's worked long and hard with Jonathan and all the movies that Jonathan has made. Jonathan said, well, if you really want to do something, why don't you guys start producing? You should get together with Gary and produce some stuff and make it. And from that union came, from that suggestion, came That Thing You Do, which was the first thing I wrote and directed as a film.
So I love that film. I wonder why you never wrote and produced another theatrical release again.
Well, in fact, I made another movie called Larry Crown. But there is value in the affection, I think, that a filmmaker has for the subject matter. And 1964 was a very, very powerful year for me because I was a conscious being who witnessed the, as any kid did, I was 7 years old, at the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And I was confused for months by what had happened to the country, but also by the demeanor of every adult that was in my life. There was a sadness. There was a crippling mystery that had gone on because of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. There were still dark clouds and furrowed brows of my dad and the teachers and their friends and every adult that I knew. And I was uncomfortable by it, and I was saddened by it, but I was also mystified by it. Then on February 11th of 1964, the Beatles were on television. And it all went away before the first commercial break of the Ed Sullivan Show. To see these guys on TV, in which everybody on the planet stopped what they were doing in order to watch it, 1964 became, I think, the most joyous year of my life. And it was all because of them and everything that followed. So when I began having these stories rattle around inside my head, I selfishly wanted to recreate that same joy that I experienced as a 7-year-old kid in February and March and April and the entire summer of 1964.
What was the first record you ever bought?
Well, I never bought 45s. The first record I actually bought was an LP named Airy by John Denver. So I didn't get around to that till I was not a the radio gave me all the musical satisfaction that I needed. The big deal for me was getting my first AM/FM radio was by a company called Sunmark. And to have a radio of my own next to my bed where I could go back and forth between my favorite stations out of Oakland and San Francisco, that was the bigger deal for me.
Did you ever put it under your pillow and pretend to be sleeping when you were actually listening to the radio?
My parents were so disinterested in what was going on in my bedroom that I didn't have to pretend anything. I could stay up as late as I wanted to.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, actually, no, it was a very good thing. I mean, my parents were so... My dad was married to the love of his life, finally. It took him 3 marriages to get there. But when they landed together, they were so busy having fun and dealing with their own Sturm und Drang that I could have been a tenant who lived downstairs.
Oh, gosh.
I just came and went on my own accord, and they never said boo. There was one time in high school, I had the flu, and I spent 2 weeks at a friend's house. And when I finally came home, my dad said, "Where have you been?" I said, "Oh, I had the flu. I slept at Kirk's house." He said, "Oh, I figured you'd take care of yourself." So that brand of freedom is not, you know, it wasn't a cruel brand of disinterest, but they were just very busy doing other things.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, it that along with attention deficit disorder made me what I am today.
I remember the first time you and I talked in 1988 when you were on Fresh Air. You were talking about how in the early days of your career, you read parts as the weird guy, the insecure guy who compensated for his insecurity by being funny. And you said they were pretty one-dimensional characters. How did you make the transition from that kind of role to playing these, you know, kind of like courageous men, like your character in Saving Private Ryan, you know, the captain and Captain Phillips, Bridge of Spies, like a lawyer. Yeah. He's not like physical courage, but it's great, like emotional and intellectual courage that was required of him. You're about to play Sully, the pilot who landed the plane on the Hudson. So how did you make that transition from the insecure, funny guy to these, you know, like courageous men who might have been scared inside, but still they rose to the occasion?
I enjoyed the confidence of actually Penny Marshall. I had made 2 movies with her. The first one was Big, which, you know,
you're an overgrown boy in that.
I played an overgrown 13 years old, which your listeners might recognize from today's interview, as a matter of fact. But then I fell into a movie called League of Their Own, in which I was playing essentially a washed up big leaguer. And after I'd had that experience, I was still in my mid-30s. I had an awful lot of opportunities and offers in order to go off and make a certain type of film, which is, you know, some brand of light comedy, some brand of, you know, quasi-romantic drama that all ended up being under the rubric of, will I ever find the person of my dreams? And it was a lucrative living, without a doubt. And there were some people that were going to be exciting to work with. And I had stacks and stacks of versions of those movies that were kind of just versions of other people that I'd played before. And after playing Jimmy Dugan, the washed-up baseball player in League of Their Own, I don't think I have an awful lot of moments of clarity in regards to anything. But I did sit down with my crackerjack team of show business experts, a guy named Richard. And I said, you know, I just don't want to play these guys anymore. And I said no for quite a while. I said no for about a year to things that that I could have done instead. And the end result of out of that, literally that conversation, came the sort of the first movie of my modern era, I think, which was Apollo 13. Mm-hmm. And then along going to that, I think I established a degree of credibility so that other people were willing to throw their lot in with me and trust me in order to take other films to their fruition.
So I want to ask you something about your childhood. When you were young, your parents divorced.
Mm-hmm. A lot.
Yes, I'm talking about the first divorce, right?
Yeah, well, they pioneered the marriage dissolution laws for the state of California. Yeah, it was like when I went to school, I was divorced. I was, the only people who had divorces were like Elizabeth Taylor and Zsa Zsa Gabor, and my mom and dad. It was
I know
a
what you
deal.
Mean. It was pretty taboo back then.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So, what year was this?
My parents separated when I was 4 or 5. 1960, 61.
Right. Okay. And you went
for the
with,
first time.
You went with your father, and that was really unusual back then. Did your father insist on taking the kids? Did your mother reject having you, or did you get to choose yourself? Like,
no, it literally came down to this. Just simple. There was only one way that it could economically work.
Uh-huh.
My mom and dad, God bless them. You know, they were together for a while, but when it was when it was time for them to divide, boy, did they know it. They needed to break up. And we were not traumatized by the reality of them getting divorced. We were just confused by the geography of it all because my mom could not afford to have 4 kids. My younger brother was born. She could take care of the baby. And my dad, he had to go off to Reno and establish residency for 6 weeks, and he had a job, so he could afford to take the 3 of us. And so off we went, and we ended up living with a lady, and she had kids, and they ended up getting married, and they were married for a couple of years. And it was not painful, other than it was occasionally lonely, because I was the youngest of the group, and everybody else went off to school, and I was left to my own devices for a couple hours every day. But really, it was just confusing because, look, Oprah was not on TV at that point, and nobody over the age of 27 knew how to communicate their feelings or explain to their children what was going on all around them. So we just kind of like went with the flow, and we moved around an awful lot. And by the time I was 10, I was actually kind of proud of this, as a matter of fact. By the time I was 10, I had lived in 10 different houses. I had had 10 different homes, 2 sets of families, a bunch of stepbrothers and stepsisters. And my dad was starting all over again with a woman who turned out to be the great love of his life, my how do I put this? My second stepmother, my second stepmom, and her kids, and of course, then that happened right in the teeth of the beginning of the 1960s. So we had all of that in order to go through as well.
Well, having several families also exposed you to several religions. I think I have this right that your mother was Catholic. Your stepmother became a Mormon for a while. You had an aunt who was a Nazarene. Did you try all those religions yourself?
We were forced to in a couple of circumstances. I was the only one in my family who did not get a First Communion because my parents broke up before they could put me into catechism. But I remember masses in Latin. I thought, of course, well, that's what church is. But then these guys, literally like the Book of Mormon, they came around in white short sleeve shirts and black ties, and they rode bicycles, and they convinced my dad's second wife that being a Mormon was just the greatest thing in the world. And my dad said, you know what, if you, Winnie, that was her name, a sweet lady, she said, if you want your kids to be baptized in the Mormon church, you go right ahead, but no way are my kids going to go through. So we just kind of like sat around and enjoyed some good Mormon family home evenings that were choreographed by Elder Paul and Brother Bob and a few other people who knew magic tricks with coins and were really funny. And all the time, my dad would sit in the living room with his hands around a can of beer that were holding holding the label to himself. He was obviously. Then when we lived with my aunt, my dad was separating from his second wife, and we went and lived with his sister. And my dad grew up in a very, very strict Methodist household that had then transformed for his sister then into the Nazarene Church. And that was, they didn't speak in tongues, but it was a very strict, fundamental Christian social circle that we lived in. We went to church. Church on Sundays was like 2 hours. Bible school was a very prescribed thing. Dinner time was the parson coming over the parson, would you do the honor of us asking the blessing? My sister and my brother and I would roll our eyes because that meant that guy was going to talk for 40 minutes. He'd have his head bowed and the operatic voice would come out. Dear Heavenly Father, we ask bountiful blessings on the Hanks family. Here we are. He would talk for, and we're just eyes closed. The food's getting cold. We're all hungry. We didn't quite really understand what was going on.
Tom Hanks, it's just been fabulous to talk with you. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it, Terry. Thanks for having me.
Tom Hanks's new movie is A Hologram for the King. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.